just before coming in, I whispered to Catherine, any suggestions for a theme for the talk? So, could I put the same whisper out to you all? So, is there any suggestions or what might make a suitable theme connected with the day rather than some other day? Yes, sir.
Expectations.
Ah, go on. Yes, yeah, go on. Yes. Any others? If I have three or four, and then I can pick the easy one. Sorry, yes.
Rituals.
Oh, that's nice, interesting. Yeah.
Meditation and daily life.
That's what we're doing, so. It may not seem like it, but it is. Yes.
The inner voice.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, yeah, good. All right. Yes, sir. Last one.
No.
Who?
No.
Love. Right. we got a few there. Wish me luck. I'll start with the first and work backwards. The last, I mean, and work backwards. just recently, Catherine and I were at a teachers' meeting in Gaia House. This is Insight Meditation teachers' meeting. Unfortunately, Stephen Fulda was unable to come due to health matters with family. And at the teachers' meeting, there were, I think, altogether about 60 people, some new teachers, some with some years of experience. Actually, I thought of Stephen at the sitting before tea time, because virtually everybody was here, and as we were sitting in the last 5 minutes, having listened to the sound of helicopters passing backwards and forwards, and fighter planes backwards and forwards all day. And just as we came to the last two or three minutes of the sitting, I remembered that the story that Stephen had told the other day at the end of the last retreat, where he said he had been called in to do army service and being interviewed by these rather severe army officers. And he said he didn't want to hold a rifle. And then there was some discussion going backwards and forwards. And then Stephen just couldn't stop laughing at the absurdity of it all. And as a result of all of this, the army officers said, we don't want you. So when the helicopter landed, you know, 100 meters from here, the thought that arose in my mind that they had changed their mind. And I know that you have just elected, as we keep reading in the West, Israel's most what's the word? Most decorated hero, or most decorated soldier. And I thought, well, perhaps Stephen could become prime minister, and he'd be Israel's least decorated soldier. However, that is rather off the point. So, at the teachers' meeting that we had, among the many people who were there at the meeting was a Buddhist nun from the monastery where I stayed, and her name is Meichi Potomwan. And Meichi Potomwan had taken ordination at the age of 12. She went to the monastery and she told her parents that she just wanted to ordain for 4 weeks. And then from 4 weeks it went to a few months and longer and longer, and she had no wish to return to the village. When she was 25, and I was the same age, which was when I took her ordination, I went to that monastery. By this time she was a Vipassana teacher in the monastery, mostly for the nuns, more than 100 nuns and lay people that came. And over the course of the years, this is 30 years now, we've become very good and very close friends. And a few years ago I asked her if she would like to come to the West, and to England in particular. And those of you who have been to Thailand will know how difficult it can be to be able to read the difference between a yes and a no. But the Thai word is chai, with a slight movement of the head. And one has to live there for several lifetimes to know if it's moving up or moving to the side. And chai can mean either way. So I asked her again, and she came. And by at that time when she first came, I think you can imagine the contrast. I think at that time it was about 37 or 38 years in the monastery. And to actually come out of the monastery, she's of course been out of the monastery to give some teachings in the neighbouring villages and in the province, but barely out of it otherwise. And to come out of the monastery and to and all the arrangements to make the trip to the West. And I went to the airport at Heathrow in London to meet her. And it was personally just a wonderful delight. And again to see her at this teacher's meeting, and to make arrangements again to help and give support for her to be able to come. And I think sometimes we see, and I think this is good example, and I'm sure others have here, where in a very sweet and wonderful way, deep friendship and warmth and contact and communication is made, and in this case made in the my years of silence there, and remains steady very, very much over many, many years. And there's a warmth and an affection and a love which just stays abiding. And I regard her as one of my very dear Dharma friends. And no, I can't speak Thai, she can't speak English, and so sometimes a translator is around and sometimes there isn't a translator, but it's the sense of something deep and common which is shared. And for Tomman is, I regard her as a saint, and always have done. And I think, again, the presence of such people in the world who embody such kindness and wisdom and deep goodness, important for us to meet and have contact with and association with. And I think that's all part of a deep abiding friendship that we can find in life with other people. And sometimes we forget that there are such people in the world. We kind of get lost in our circles, whatever they may be. And sometimes it is rather very important, in fact, to recognize this extension of the heart and ways that can manifest in life and make contact in life and be sustained through many, many years. And that serves as a real strength and support to all of us. Taking into matters of the heart there and going deeper with that, There's a, rather, in, and someone referred to this in indirect ways in a small group today, the Buddha's given the teachings and he speaks quite frequently of what is referred to as the ten directions. And sometimes in the language of spiritual practice and in the language of metaphor, we quite often refer, of course, to one primarily, and the one which we use most frequently is going deep. And this going deep metaphor seems to be the sense of it, and the perception and the view of it seems to be we are in one place, and we imply that that's less deep, we imply that's shallow, and then we develop our practices, we develop our meditations, and we go from one place we call less deep, or whatever we wish to call it, everyday mind, and then we go deep. And we say that we are going deep by the kind of description which we give to our experience. And so there's a kind of criteria which we use for being deeper. And we might say, well, when I'm more deep, I'm more still. And we might say I'm more silent. I'm thinking less. I feel more steady. I feel more in touch with myself. There's more calmness of being, and there is less going on in my mental life. So then we have a range of experience which is taking place, and that range of experience seems to be, at times I'm not so deep, at times I'm going deeper, and at other times I feel very deep. And when we have had some taste of feeling deeper, we're not so lost in our personal storyline, we're not so lost in yesterday or tomorrow or in all the fantasy life that goes on, we feel genuinely that we're going deeper. It is somewhat metaphorical as well, and there's a certain quality and a certain satisfaction in doing it that way. The same can be said when it's more difficult, but it is another expression of going deep. So sometimes, as a number of you have reported over the days, that just in the flow of the day, of the meditation, in various times, one has touched a deep place inside. That deep place may be a deep place of hurt, or a deep place of pain, or a very distressing memory from long time ago, or an issue which is unresolved and has gone on for a long time. And again, in the very painful difficulty that's going on within, sometimes you say, I really have touched a really deep place inside of me, and it's now, as we say, come up. So again, there's a movement going on inside, and sometimes we say the language of stuff or issues or problems coming up. So we look at our meditation practices, and we tend to look at it along this kind of spectrum. Going deep, hopefully staying deep, going deep, stuff coming up, having to deal with it, working our way through it, and then going deep again. But there's a certain kind of line, as it were, so to speak, that goes along with it. The difficulty with this is that if you, like with anything in life, if you and I adopt that view, and you and I say to ourselves and to each other, well, that's what meditation is about, and only about that, it's only about going deeper and letting go of the superficial stuff and going deeper, there's actually a restriction going on with us, because we've got a model, we've got a determination of what going deep is, and then we might forget all the directions. In that, sometimes, and the two references I gave, going deep, which is bringing out some unresolved suffering, going deep, which is bringing us to deeper peace of being and contentment, we actually realize the mind is, and the inner life is quite extraordinary, because both can be genuinely real and are real expressions of what we refer to as going deep. The Buddha had a conversation, a meeting with a Jain. Mahavira was the founder of the Jains, and the Jains had meditation teachings. The Jains had a very strict philosophy or practice or ethic of non-violence, non-harming, much stricter than the Buddhist tradition. And I'm going to the detail of that. One day, the Buddha saw one of those in the Jain tradition doing his practice, and the Buddha said to him, what's your practice? What are you doing? And he said, I'm meditating. In this case, he was actually meditating in the standing posture, but it could be standing posture or sitting posture. And then the Buddha said to him, Why are you meditating? And his response was, I think it's an important aspect, and the Buddha's response is very important. The Jain practitioner said, by engaging in my meditation of being here and now as the core meditation, he said, three things are occurring, and that's the intention behind my meditation. One is, by just being here meditating and being right here and now, he said, I am not creating any new karma. I'm not making new karma. The second reason that I'm meditating, he said, by meditating here and now, I am working out all my old karma, working out all my old samskaras, that means all my old formations, the unsatisfied, all the old influences, all the old patterns, all the old tendencies. By not making new karma, by working out my old karma, I will then work out all the rest of my karma, and then I'll be, he said, a jiva mukti. Jiva means life, mukti means liberation. I'll be a life which is liberated. I'll be a liberated one. I will know moksha. This same perception and view and position is also quite common in the Buddhist world. The Buddha's response wasn't easy for the Jain to hear. He said, quote precisely, this is useless effort and useless striving to know liberation. Useless was the word he used. Well, I can't imagine the Jain would have been too thrilled with that. So sometimes we listen, we say, well, that seems quite reasonable. Be here and now, not make any new karma, and therefore have to work it all out. Let the old karma come, let it work its way through the body, the mind, etc., etc., and work it. And then one is free when it's no more working out. The Buddha said to him, what percentage have you worked out? How much? And the Jain said, well, I'm not sure, I don't know. The Buddha said to him, how much have you got left to go? And the Jain said, I've no idea how much is left. And one has to remember, this is India, we're talking past lives here. And then the Buddha said, how will you know when it's completely exhausted? I don't know how I'll know. So you don't know how much you've got rid of, you don't know how much you've got left, and you've got no idea what it would be like not to have any. Sometimes, I'm not going to say what else he said, but sometimes we adopt a position, we hear it, we're told it, it sounds reasonable, etc., etc., authority figures tell us this position, or whatever, and the mind says it is reasonable, but it seems inexhaustible. To actually look at that, remembering that we're talking not just all the silly things that we did in this lifetime, I mean, we're going way back. And to actually imagine that sitting here in the here and now, meditating, and say, okay, let the next lot of karma come by, and we're just exhausted. You know, it'd be a little bit like being on one of those silly military parades where those silly boys are standing there like this and the troops are going by and the tanks are going by and the bazookas are going by and this silly fellow is standing here doing this and I'm not sure he must have an itch in his head or something and we're expected to be meditative anymore. So sometimes we have a kind of view which takes place that the body of the teachings and the core kind of message that goes on for us is somehow working everything out. And the language has crept into the culture a great deal of inner work, along with the language of going deep There are situations and times where it's valid, but this is important, the residue impression is, oh, that's what it's about. It's only about going deep, it's only about here and now, and it's only about working everything out. And this opinion or this standpoint or position takes a grip on us because either authorities say so or because it sounds reasonable or both. And we look at that kind of task and I think anyone looking at it with a little bit more space around it sees it, the magnitude of what one is even considering from past to present. And if we then start viewing that anything that's going on in our body, any unpleasant experiences, any painful experiences, anything that's going on in the body is, oh, it's old karma working its way through old samskaras, then the Buddha is lying his head off. Because he reports pain in the body. He reports in the text backache while sitting, which is comfort. Some give some comfort for those who have backache. Oh, the Buddha had it. Oh, great. So, if one takes the view in life, anything which arises through the body is karma and samskaras, in terms of painful experience or whatever, then no human being can realize the end of their karma. If one takes that view. But nowhere in the text, in the teachings of the Buddha, has that statement ever been made, and never would. He's not so foolish. So sometimes, in our being, and in our practice, and in going deeper, we may have to, so to speak, hold rather lightly, constantly trying to go deep, constantly trying to work everything out, and maybe just see that that's a relative thing, that it has a usefulness in our practice. Because the difficulty with the view is, especially going deep view, whether into the painful situations or deep into contentment, or deep into peace, or just feeling very deep in a lovely, sweet way. How can anybody know where the end of this depth actually is? What person in their depth is going to be able to say, unless it sounds conceited, well, you know, I've gone so deep. One can't go any deeper than this. Now, if I was to hear that, I'd feel, as a deep Dharmati, I'd feel very, very concerned about the mind which says, oh, I can't go any deeper than this. There, it would seem rather conceited to make that claim. When does one say, in going deep, how far I need to go? Where is the end of going deep? And so sometimes we get this view of trying to get to the end of depth, and yet we cannot ever come to a point and say, well, that's the end of the deep. I can't go any further than that. And therefore it seems there's an extraordinary potential to go deep, 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 deep. And in going deep, 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 it doesn't seem we can stay down there very long. And then gradually, not with any intention or willpower, the energy changes, the focus changes, the vitality changes, the heart changes, there's movement that's going on, and then we say, I was so deep. God, I had such a deep experience today. Yeah. But now I'm gradually like an escalator lift. I'm so deep, and now the lift is moving me back up, and I'm back up in the attic, in my brain cells, in my mind again, and I had such a lovely... So this movement that goes on there, just as I say, to have some space around it, so that we're not getting stuck in exploration for liberation, in just viewing it in terms of how deep or not deep I am. Not just viewing it and keep measuring ourselves in that way. How is it? Buddha speaks of all the directions. Beautiful, beautiful, lovely teachings on this. All the directions. We easily, may not be with ego or fixation or obsession, but easily get a fixation, easily get an interest, easily get an interest in one of them, going deep. But what about letting the language drop, letting the metaphorical interpretation drop? So that we're not comparing so strongly one form of experience with another form and constantly wanting to get back to the other one, which is more preferable. And therefore there is some capacity that we have to, and the important thing is the capacity to embrace what's, let's say, ordinary mind. And there's an awareness which also correspondingly braces the other side of the duality called depth. We can embrace both. Sometimes in that movement, in the deep inside, sometimes the inner voice arises. But the difficulty with the inner voice that arises, do we give the inner voice authority? It would be easier if, in looking into ourselves and in the inner voice, if only one inner voice arose. But quite often it's like a chai shop down there. And one voice inside of oneself says, do this, and the other says, well, I don't think I really should, and the other inner voice is there, and they both can seem equally as strong there, And there seems to be a kind of conviction there. And then, to contribute to the confusion, one makes the mistake of asking somebody else, like Catherine, what she thinks would be best, or me, or Stephen, or whatever. And lo and behold, what happens? There's now a third voice in there, with another position altogether. Someone started off with one voice, it went to two, it went to three. None of them seem quite right. Someone is looking for somebody who looks like they're in a silent retreat but might talk. Someone goes and finds somebody else. Sometimes the poor managers, they're on the receiving end. People are going into the kitchen because they've got three voices. Well, why not have four or five? So all this can be going on inside. And I'd say, so it's rather difficult at times to know what's the true and authentic voice, especially when there's one or the other. Sometimes, when there is more depth, one aspect of the inner voice that takes place is sometimes we know the inner voice is a little bit unfamiliar. That may be a valuable signal, it may not. It takes awareness, again, is the main thing. A little bit unfamiliar. What I mean by that is, let's say one has some fears. Fears about taking steps. Fears about taking risks. Fears about extending oneself beyond the familiar and beyond the known. And the old voice may be holding back, contracting, and giving all the reasons why not to respond. But there's something inside of oneself, hopefully, intuitively and respectfully, sensitively, which says it's important to take the risk. It's important to make the step. It's important to explore something in a fresh way. And though there may be the hesitations, and though there may be the old voices which says, no, stay with the known, even no matter how distressing it is, and how painful it is, and how anxiety-provoking it is. So sometimes the voice which is fresh and new and unfamiliar, sometimes is calling on us and encouraging us to take fresh steps, to take risks. And sometimes we need to hear that voice. We don't know why it's there. We can't even explain where it came from or whatever. But there is, and it's the important thing, there is an awareness and a knowing that it's necessary. Because we feel that in some way it genuinely is contributing to our development as a human being, our exploration as a human being, our expansion as a human being. And if we are truly engaged in the art, and it's a great art of life, of inner listening, and we really are listening well and clearly and as effectively as possible, that will shine through and there will be the capacity to make steps. We'll actually hear the encouragement to do it. Sometimes we know, in some matters, there's no real choice. And it itself, those initiatives and steps that we make, and sometimes some risk, we don't know what the outcome will be, that in making those risks, it's the voice of what? It's the voice of freedom. And suddenly there's a deeper kind of shift which is going on, and one isn't therefore viewing it so much, oh, I've got to work out all my karma, I've got to work out all my samskaras and not make anything new, and that time-bound imprisonment model. We're actually sensing and receptive in another way. If you're listening to what I say, and you have religious dispositions, should be very easy to translate what I'm saying into religious language here. So sometimes there is a deep, expansive receptivity. There's an inner listening which is going on, and the inner listening which is going on is bringing something to us which is unknown, unfamiliar, and challenges and takes risks, and there is something that allows us to respond to that which we can't grab hold of. And it's quite a different kind of relationship to existence than feeling as an ideology, I've got to keep working everything out. It's a different sense of what the being can be receptive to. And it seems to be coming out of the here and now, and it seems to be, doesn't seem to be coming from working things out from the past. It's a different sense of the outpouring of direction. It's an extraordinary thing. And our silence and our stillnesses and our meditations begin to make that more and more clear. The sense of something other, which is extraordinarily close, which brings out something which has an authentic voice to it. So a percentage, a part of our meditations in that respect, are a kind of stabilizing. And in the stabilizing practices which we are doing, and stabilizing practices are a key term in the Buddhist tradition, it's an important term. That in the stabilizing practices that we are engaged in, the stabilizing practice will make the voice much more focused, much more steady, much more anchored, and it will be coming from something which one's not able to put into the language. Comes of something which one feels almost offensive to put the word to. Sometimes the strength of the voice is vital in certain situations. This is not unusual, and I think probably most days on retreats, in various forms and aspects, I hear this. One says, I had this difficult experience in the past, and even though the incident or the experience has finished, I keep feeling the echo of it. I keep feeling the reverberations of it. And so when I'm in anything which is similar, it's like I'm thrown back into that same old pattern, or that same old pain, or that same old worry or anxiety. And I keep looking at the past, at what happened then, and yet it keeps affecting me, and so it makes things difficult for me when I'm in anything which is remotely similar to it. I just find the same nervousness coming up, or the same agitation, or the same problem, or the same fears, or the same pull towards, or whatever it might be. I mean, and sometimes we think, therefore, I've got to try to work it out. It may be helpful. But sometimes we can know very well the causal conditions, yet still the impact is still going on. Even though we've thought about it, we've reflected at it, we've looked at it, we've had skilled people look at it with us. Sometimes the voice has to come, as I said, from the here and now, and not be the effect of the past. And what I mean by that is, something which has some conviction to it is, however it may be stated or phrased, here and now is here and now, and what's past is finished and dead. Sometimes the voice has to be strong and firm and authoritative from within oneself to make it very clear to oneself that past is past and the past is dead, it is finished, and we don't have to carry it from that to the present. Some people hear and they go, not likely. Just sounds terribly suppressive. it sounds like denial, it sounds like avoidance, or whatever. If it is, all that will happen is it will come back up. It will just bounce straight back sooner or later or whatever. So they say sometimes the voice out of the here and now, the power out of the here and now, the energy out of the here and now, which is always without exception far greater than images, memories and the dustbin of history, is that you and I, we need, as it were, to tap in to the power of the here and now, the authority of the here and now, the energy of the here and now, and see there is something much more powerful and alive about it than the virtual reality of memories, of images, of stories, of pictures, of ideas, of that floating world. And therefore, teachings have said, the Buddha used this word, adhidhana, he says. Dhana is like station. Those of you who've been to India know Patankot, Patana, Tana, station, or foundation. Adi means a kind of higher form, another form. It means that we make, in this case, the station, the stopping place, the finishing place, right here. We make that the foundation. And on the foundation of that, we don't have to be living as a kind of prisoner of what was. But it takes voice, the inner voice of authority, it takes, of course, outer voice of authority, it takes the power of the here and of the here and now. And once again, it gives us more and more the sense. In fact, there may be much less to work out for everybody in this room than what you think. Than what you think. You may actually be much closer to immediate liberation than what your mind or your memory is telling you. It's very unreliable. And so even though the thought may arise with a great deal of conviction, well, that might be for everybody else in the room, but it definitely isn't for me, and that I've got, metaphorically speaking, so far to go, you wouldn't believe that the idea of any kind of freedom within the next 27 lifetimes is just beyond belief for me. So the view can arise, the opinion can arise, the standpoints can arise, but when has life ever taken any notice of anything we've thought about? When has life actually said thoughts and the view of it meet together? Hasn't it been that much of the thought which have gone on, probably a rather high percentage, like 101%, no, not quite, but rather a high percentage of thoughts, haven't had any real relationship to anything? Anything. They've just been floating out of the brain cells. Yeah. And we've got this strange idea that there is a little sequence of them with the I at the beginning of them which says, I know I've got a long way to go. And this one we take out and we hold to. And we have the same kind of conviction with it as the poor Jain doing his sitting meditation, trying to work out rebirth since time immemorial. So maybe not only we need to the awareness which embraces shallow and deep, not only do we need to have a greater sense of all the directions, but we need also a little bit of humour about our views and opinions about where we are in this world. And unfortunately, every time there is, so to speak, some arising of some difficulty, in the arising of the difficulty, we say, well, there's the proof. There's the proof that I'm useless. There's the proof that I'm a human aberration of existence. There's the proof it's going to take millenniums or whatever the view is. So in the difficulty, the view, as I say, consolidates it, and then the self keeps reinforcing itself. How come? The Buddha speaks, some of you will know, heard this concept, of the noble ones. And the first kind of noble one is one who knows liberation, who knows moksha, liberation, knows what it is to be a mukti, a liberated one. And like the sun shining, clouds arising, and the Buddha makes it explicitly, unambiguously clear that there is freedom, and yet in that freedom issues still arise. Problems still arise, greed still arises, confusion still arises, delusion still arises. So then the teaching has never said, first we make ourselves perfect. Then once we're perfect, we'll have the biggest buzz of all time. It's such a daft viewpoint. So then, one of those who understood their liberation, understood their freedom, acknowledged that issues still arose in the relative world, understood the timeless freedom, issues still arising and attending to. And one of the practitioners, a noble one, a Sri Mantra, as they're called, that means in English metaphor, it's the same as turning the corner. There's no falling back. One knows freedom, it can't be lost. And then the Buddha was asked, how long before the rest of the stuff that swirls around in the inner life, how long before it's exhausted, it's gone, it's lost its power? Not through working out, it's just organically, naturally lost its power. And he said, and I think the probably the first thing that came out of his head, he just said, oh, probably seven lifetimes. About seven lifetimes. What I mean, what I think, the way I understand it, sometimes the Buddhist tradition says, well, that's exactly seven, because they're keen on the number. But I think it's much more a statement and accumulation, an acknowledgement. Give time for the power of all that to exhaust itself. You know, so there's not a tremendous pressure. My God, I know what freedom is, but yet there are still issues going on for me, and golly, I'm 78 years of age. I've got to get my act together and exhaust the rest of it very quickly, or something like that. So there can be great freedom shining in all the directions. Still, aspects and features are there to attend to and to work on and to work with and to deal with. One is made noble in life through this liberation, and one isn't putting an incredible pressure on oneself, because it only intensifies problems in life, to work diligently, practice diligently, and work on the exhaustion of all of that. And this is stated again and again in the text to be what a noble human being is. This is to live with nobility. It doesn't come obviously through birth, as these strange English people seem to think, and it doesn't come through privilege or whatever. One isn't made noble by having these silly titles in front of one's name. One is made noble by liberation and the ethics of it and the kindness of it and the awarenesses of it that goes in all the directions.